Well, it's January the 7th, 2005, and here in the MSU Library we have as our very special guest today Robert Vassin, and to interview him, John Metzler of the African Studies Centre of MSU, and myself, Peter Lim. Welcome both of you here to the African Studies series. Let me start by asking you, Bob, to speak a little about your early life growing up in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Fine. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to the interview. I think I'd like to start by saying that my life in South Africa was a very ordinary, very average life. The difference is that I think I was born in very unusual and abnormal times. The Fordsburg into which I was born was typical of three or four ghetto areas. By ghetto I mean areas set aside for Indian occupation with some coloured people in there. I don't know if I need to perhaps elaborate. Given the apartheid system in South Africa, everything was done according to race. So we belonged to a group called Indian, despite the fact that I think perhaps 1% of people had ever seen India. We were classified as Indian. And we lived in Fordsburg, which was one of the ghettos, the other two being Doornfontein and Friedendorp. I mention this in the context that there was only one school to service these places, and that was in Fordsburg. So there was a tremendous pressure on the school to accommodate all the children.
This was secondary school?
Primary school.
Only one primary school.
And the other thing is that education for the black population, and by black I mean Indian, coloured and African, education was not compulsory. So I went to school when I was 8 years, I was over 8 years old when I first went to school.
When was that roughly? Was that the early 50s or the late 40s?
1946.
46.
When I started school.
That was when you started primary school?
That was when I started primary school.
And of course that was an interesting time in South Africa, because that was when the Indian Congress was starting, the Doctors Pact, they were starting to protest against segregation and then apartheid.
Right.
But of course as a young boy you were probably not aware of that, or were you? Because one of the...
I remember the passive resistance campaign. Mm. Mm-hmm. Because there was lots of activity in places like Fordsburg. But we were too young to know exactly what it meant. But we certainly were aware that there was something happening. And, of course, friends told us, parents told us a little bit about it, but not a lot. The other thing about growing up in Fordsburg, which might be of interest, is the total lack of facilities for us. We had a cinema, and that was it. There were no playing fields, no place where you could play. I mention this because we had to develop our own ways of creating sports arenas for ourselves, and that was the street.
Could I back up just a little bit about mm-hmm. Fordsburg for my own reference? This was pre-apartheid then, if you're talking about the early 1940s.
The grand apartheid. There was a color bar.
Yes, that's what I was saying. So yeah. That there was this de jure or was it just de facto segregation? Were there actually laws in the books that segregated the mm-hmm. people of Asian heritage? And
those laws were already place and were being enforced, so we could only live there. The other thing about being Indian in South Africa in what I mentioned earlier were the abnormal times was that Indians were restricted to the province in which they had been born, which they were born into. So we were in the Transvaal. And this meant that we could never live in the Cape or in Natal. The other province was the Orange Free State, which barred Indians completely. If you were Indian and you wanted to go to the Cape, you needed to get a permit. And in addition to that, you could only be in the Orange Free State for a total of 24 hours. Mm. So no Indians ever lived there.
And this sort of these restrictions went back a long way in some cases, and we even saw Mahatma Gandhi at the turn of the century leading a march, I think, from Natal into across the border into the Transvaal. So these went way back into into the settler history of South Africa. I'm just wondering, Bob, then, as you progress through primary school, and I guess we start to move into the 50s, and the 50s was, of course, a momentous decade in South Africa with resistance and the imposition of ever more harsher apartheid laws. Maybe you could just dwell a little. And it was also a great decade of cultural activity, I think. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you recall of the 50s. Maybe some people and places.
1952 was the defiance campaign. There were a set of laws which the ANC, together with the Indian Congresses and other groups, decided to fight against and or defy these laws. And this was the defiance campaign. And I remember that fairly well. That was 1952. One of the things that we were asked to do was visit people who had been detained. And I remember carrying a packet of cigarettes. I didn't smoke then, but carrying cigarettes. And when we could, we threw them over like a cage for the detainees. Ah. So that was the sum total of that experience. Then 55 was, of course, the Freedom Charter in Kliptown. And the one I remember particularly well was 1956, the treason trial. And that was one of the awakenings for our peers, our groups and our friends and family, because a number of people from Natal who came to the treason trial, which was in Pretoria, had to be housed privately, and a number of them stayed in Fordsburg. And it was that time that I met people like Billy Nyer. I'd met Mac a little earlier. I'll talk about Mac in a minute.
That's Mac Maharaj.
N.T. Nyker, M.P. Nyker, who became very active, was also involved in Sechaba and also in exile in London later years. So we met all these people, and they would tell us about something about the trial. We met them more socially, and but they made quite an impact on our young lives and were able to give us guidance. If I can backtrack a little bit,
sure.
Talking about my politicization, around about 1949, we used to go to classes. And we didn't know at that time who it had been arranged by. But there was a little madrasa hall, just a little box.
That's an Islamic school.
That's
a madrasa.
Right, yeah. During the day. But this was in the evenings, once a month. We were able to go there. And we had speakers like Hilda Bernstein, who was then Hilda Watts, Ruth First, Eddie Rue, and a number of other speakers who came to talk to us about their travels, etc. Hilda Watts spoke to us about China. Ruth First spoke to us about Europe, and Eddie Rue spoke to us about apartheid generally in South Africa. And this was the first sort of political classes. We, of course, saw them as great social events where we could get together and listen to people. It was like a travelogue for us, but in a sense, it was really the beginning of our politicization. Years later, when I came to Michigan, I discovered that the person who had organized these was Ahmed Kathrada.
Ah.
So that's just an aside. But getting back to the 50s, those were, you know, I started talking about the treason trial. I also attended some of the treason trial, especially towards the end, because by then Kathrada had become a very good friend of ours, and we sort of met socially. I should point out that I never was involved in any political work with Kathrada. Our meetings were always social, but he had a tremendous influence on our lives to the point that, you know, he recruited people like Isu Chiba, Reggie Vandya, Indris Naidu, and they in turn recruited us into the movement on a much more serious level. I don't know if I should perhaps start talking about that at this point, or is there anything else you want to know about?
Well, we could, yeah, we perhaps should move into that, but before we do, maybe you could also mention another event in 56 was the famous Women's March.
Can
you recall that, against apartheid?
We didn't have television. Mm. Everything was fairly restricted. News was not all that easy to come by. But we knew of the march because there were people from the Indian community who were involved. Rahima Musa was one of the key people. She marched with Lillian Goyi and Helen Joseph to actually hand over the petition in Pretoria. So we remember that part of it. And travel was difficult those days for us. There was very little money, and it wasn't easy if you were in the black population to travel from A to B, because everything was segregated.
Mm. Mm.
So I didn't actually go to Pretoria, but I do recall and remember the event.
And that's an interesting question that you raised about the transmission of information under apartheid. Because TV only came in the 70s because the apartheid regime was so scared of the power of TV, and I suppose newspapers and word of mouth, therefore, were very important in finding out about these news things.
Word of mouth, sometimes we got information formally through newspaper like The Drum, the magazine Drum. There was The Leader, which was an Indian paper. And then, of course, as we got more involved, we used to read New Age and Guardian under its various names before it got banned and started again as something else. So we used to always get those papers, and that was a good source of information for us. Information that would not be in papers like the Rand Daily Mail or the Star.
So by 56, were you what were you yourself doing by then? Were you still in school, or were you starting to work? Or
I was in high school.
In high school.
And by then I had joined the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress. This perhaps shows how naive we were. I honestly believe that it was the duty of everyone in the community to belong to the Indian Youth Congress. So we became part of that. And there were classes, sometimes formal, sometimes informal, but we were kept informed, so we knew all about, you know, the evenings when people went to write on the walls and distribute leaflets, and we would do things like that. June the 26th was an important day in the political calendar. And in high school, we would arrange and boycott classes. We would try to close down the entire school on the 26th. This was called Hartal. It's an Indian word meaning suffering, I think. So we would do that. The teachers or the school administrators would then call in the police, and this often resulted in baton charges. Perhaps I can just talk a little bit about high school, because I think that's important. Primary school, all our teachers were from the black community. When we got to high school, all our teachers were white teachers. And this makes sense if you look at how apartheid worked and what the philosophy was. Underlying that, was the idea that blacks could not be teachers beyond primary level, that they didn't have the wherewithal to teach in a high school. So white teachers were the ones who were recruited. We got two types of white teachers. The ones who would not be able to get jobs in white schools because they were so mediocre, and we had a lot of them. And the second group were those who wanted to do something for the community. Those were the good guys. So I remember when I was in matric, and we had to take a mock exam, and they would then put your name forward for writing the matric exams, which was the last year of high school. And we had exams on the 26th of June, which was the day we normally boycott.
Yes.
And I remember one was science and the other was Latin. And of course we refused to go. So the following week we went and given our results. And what was so interesting was that all the people, there were about 80% of us boycotted classes that day. All of us were given a pass grade in science.
Even though you weren't there.
We weren't there. And some of those who had taken the mock exam actually failed.
there's a lesson there.
I think this says a lot about the teacher. He was a wonderful human being who I would later meet at fundraisers in the Congress of Democrats, which was the white organization allied to the African National Congress. Mm-hmm. And likewise with the Latin teacher, he gave us a special test that we could take.
Now, if we can back up just a little bit on the high school. The high school was not in Forbesburg then. You said
the high school, that was the only high school in Johannesburg as well.
So there was one primary school and one high school, and both in Forbesburg. Now, in terms of the teachers, you said they were European, of European heritage. This was before the regulations that went in later on, that Afrikaans was the language of instruction. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. So English was the medium of instruction. Were any of the teachers Afrikaans?
Oh, there were a number of Afrikaner teachers who were diehard nationalists, and they were vicious. Corporal punishment was acceptable. There were no procedures to go through. They would haul you out in front of the class and cane you. And we used to get caned regularly or beaten regularly. I remember a history class one day when we were talking about it was civic history, and the teacher then said, well, Indians were given the opportunity to have representation in parliament but refused. And I mentioned the passive resistance campaign and what a sham it would have been to have representation by a white person who had nothing or no knowledge of what was happening in the community. And I said that, anyway, you don't have representation based on race. Well, I got thrown out of that class, not for just that day, but for the entire term.
Wow.
When he walked in, I had to walk out. Eventually, the principal found out, and he caned me and then expelled me. So I was expelled for about 2 or 3 weeks. My mother had to go back and plead, and he told my mother that I'm getting too involved in politics.
That raises the interesting question of the family, and recently reading the memoirs of Ahmed Kathrada, he mentions that in a way your family was his family. Maybe you'd like to move into Kathy now and talk a little bit about the unfolding of the struggle, and maybe some other people who might have appeared on the scene, like I don't know, Yusuf Dadu or the Mandelas, your wife.
Okay. I met Kathy around about 1955 or 56. he was a friend, a very good friend of my brother's, and my brother brought him home, and this was how one entertained. Everything was done at home. And that was the focal point for all socialization. And we became very good friends, and my mum really adored him, and he was alone. He was a bachelor. He had a very difficult life. So Kathy also always used to say that when I wanted to get away from everything and just, you know, try to forget the political dimension of my life, I would always go to the Vassons, and we would eat and talk and chat and play Scrabble or bridge or whatever. So he became very much part of the family. In fact, I was flattered when in his book he mentions that on his 50th birthday he thought of all of us and how he regarded Tommy and me as his brothers. So this is the closeness. Although I did mention earlier that at no point did Kathy try to recruit us. But what had happened around about that time, 1959, 1960, was talks of trying to have a peaceful solution of a roundtable conference with Chief Lutuli was hitting a blank wall with the government. Mm. So that in the end, you know, they just decided, well, tactics have to change. Trying to create changes through peaceful means was not going to happen.
It was Sharpeville in 1960, vicious repression by the apartheid government this time. Yeah.
And so in December 16th, 1961, there was the formation of the Umkhonto Wesizwe, the Spear of the Nation. And I mentioned earlier that Kathy had recruited Lalu Chiba, and eventually Lalu Chiba recruited me, and I became a member of Umkhonto Wesizwe. That was in 1962.
Did you have any hair-raising escapades as an MK member?
I think the first thing I want to say is how much respect I still have for the way the whole MK operation was set up. No life had to be taken. There were to be no injuries. No innocent passers-by had to be injured in any way or form whatsoever. And I think this is one reason why there wasn't that much activity, or there could have been a lot more acts of sabotage if we weren't restricted by this. And it was adhered to so that what we did was a lot of surveillance. You would choose your target. We were divided into little cells. There were four in a cell. And we each had a responsibility, and responsibilities would change depending on the operation. And we would, having chosen the target, keep surveillance on that, do a time and motion study, I suppose, look at how often people passed by, when the quietest time was, and then when we were absolutely sure that this could go ahead, we would then inform our leader. Our leader would then contact whoever had to be contacted to get the wherewithal to commit the act. Mm. So it wasn't... I suppose the one experience that stands out in my mind was the night we were going to bomb Forsberg Post Office. Uh-huh. And this was after perhaps a month of surveillance. And everything had gone smoothly. I was on lookout duty. That had gone well. The other person on the lookout, that was okay. Everything was set, and then we dispersed. And I lived not all that far from the post office. So I was sat outside on the veranda waiting to hear this glorious explosion. Nothing happened. The material that we had been given was faulty, so nothing happened. But in the morning paper, that was in the Rand Daily Mail, the official paper of the Johannesburg, headlines, this act of sabotage fails, giving all the information, but they had picked up fingerprints. So the leader of our cell had to leave within minutes, which he did. I never ever saw him again. He went to Dar es Salaam. From Dar es Salaam he went to Canada, and he died a very tragic death in Canada. I still have contact with his family, but that was the sort of sum total. And then, of course, again, another facet that I find fascinating. My brother and I lived in the same house, and around the corner was my cousin. And I didn't know, despite the fact that we lived in the same house, that he was involved. He didn't know I was involved. We thought my cousin had given up once he had got married and was now totally inactive. And then we got a message from prison, because people were being detained under the 90 days, 180 days or so. There were always people being thrown into jail. And a message got smuggled out in code that so-and-so had to leave. Because it was in code, I thought it was me. My brother thought it was him. My cousin thought that the message was for him. So the three of us all
disappeared.
Just leave to go underground. And that's when I discovered that my brother was involved, and my cousin was involved, and they discovered I was involved. So in a way, I think what that shows is the security and the discipline.
Yes, of that period. Amazing times.
Yeah.
And were you married by this time?
Yes, I was. And I got married in 63.
Yeah. When you were underground, was it?
After a while, we were able to come out again.
Yeah.
We would always get a message from someone to say, you're okay. So in that respect, we were able to function normally. So I had to go back and teach. But there were two occasions when I had to just drop my teaching duties, and I felt awful about that. But there was nothing one could do.
So by now you were teaching in Fordsburg?
I was teaching at a school halfway between Johannesburg and Pretoria called Waterfall Group 2 School, which was set aside for Asian, children of Asian origin. And it was popularly known as Mia's Farm. I mention this because it also had a political dimension. The area, not the school in necessarily. It's where all the big meetings were held under the guise of a picnic.
Right. And your wife, Ursula, she was working, and how did you...
She was working, and...
She was a social worker?
Oh, she worked, first of all, she worked in the government union office. That's when she met Winnie Mandela, and Nelson Mandela would give her and her sister a ride to the bus stop every day. That's how Ursula got to know the Mandelas. Ursula then went to work for a legal firm, and they were just below Mandela and Tambo.
Ah, that's interesting.
In Ferreira Town.
I recently saw that old office in a Canadian video of Mandela, and they go back to that office, and it's now being occupied by squatters. It's a very interesting place.
Do we have time for him to talk a little bit about university then? Because you went to university before you taught, or did you teach immediately after?
No. After high school, I went to university. I went to university in 1958, and we were...
What university was that?
Witwatersrand University. Yeah. And it was the end of that year that the University Extension Act came in, which made us the last of the blacks to be admitted to WITS. And we were active, but I was also extremely cautious and suspicious. But that's going back, that was in the late 50s.
Was this before you became a member of MK, or is this...
No, before. MK was 1962.
So after you were...
So after. I was... I'd begun teaching, so I had two careers. I had one in teaching and one in MK.
Okay.
So given the tension and the repression with the banning of the ANC in 1960 and the formation of MK that you joined, I guess sooner or later you were giving your marching orders, and you end up in exile. Maybe you could just relate how you actually left the country, and then we could maybe move into a brief discussion of life in exile.
Right. 1964 was an awful year. It was really one of the worst years for so many of us. The Rivonia trial had come to an end. Everyone was sentenced to life imprisonment. They were beginning their life sentence. Babla Saluji, a very good friend, also in the Indian Youth Congress, had been detained and then murdered by the secret police. He was thrown from the 10th floor of this special branch building. And I was at school one morning, and a call came through, which was very unusual because you weren't allowed to get calls while teaching, no telephone calls whatsoever. But this was obviously important. I was called down to the office, and it was my father. And he said that the special branch had finally been able to locate him, and they wanted to question me. And he said that he was able to tell them that he hadn't seen us for the past 12 years because my mum and dad had divorced, and he was able to say quite convincingly that he had no idea where we were. He had lost contact with us, which was of course not true. We saw him every day. And I then did something which I still think was pretty stupid. I finished work and I went to the headquarters of the special branch, the security police, and I went up to the very place where Babla Saluji had been tortured and killed, and I said, I believe Sergeant Taylor wants to speak to me. And they said, 1 minute, and they went through and they said, Sergeant Taylor's not in. So I said, well, tell him I called, and I'll call again, and left it at that and went back, and I reported this immediately to a superior in the organization. And they said, well, that was a pretty dumb thing to have done, but it might be something that will give you a few hours. Don't go to work and go to a safe house. So I said, all right. So that evening I wrote out a letter of resignation to the school and gave that to my cousin, the same cousin who was also teaching at the school, and awaited orders. And that was Tuesday, the 13th of October. On the 14th, I was told I had to leave, and whether I had a passport or not. So I said, I did have a passport. I said, get a ticket and go. So I got a ticket, and through someone who knew everything about the airport, they were able to get me through customs and immigration, and I flew off on the 14th of October. One suitcase, my son was 6 months old, my mother was there, Ursula was there, and I had no choice. I left.
You had to go by yourself?
I went by myself.
Where did you go?
I went to London.
To London.
And I chose London because I had an uncle, so I felt that at least there was someone I could go to.
What was it like then, this exile experience? Because I think you spent an awful long time in England, and it was an awful long time before you ever saw South Africa again.
27 years.
It's an amazing that period of time. But also, I guess, this was a period of the beginning of consolidation in England by the ANC in exile.
Right. Was it 16? In the beginning, we didn't do all that much. We weren't organized. There were lots of South Africans, and all we did was what we were able to, and we did it personally. So in the school where I taught, I would try to bring in what was happening in South Africa. I was then teaching in a high school in London. It was after the Morogoro conference, was that 69?
Hmm.
I think that the ANC was going to be open to all. So this meant that there would be one organization, because when I left South Africa, I was a member of the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress, although I was also recruited into MK, but that was seen as very separate. You weren't a member of the African National Congress necessarily, but you could belong to MK.
And did you join the ANC in 69 or thereabouts?
No, it was later. You couldn't join. You got invited.
Oh, you got invited.
You got invited.
Yes, of course. Yes.
That was because of security. So only once that was cleared. So the structures in London, I think, started around about 1977, where we formed ourselves into units. London being so big,
yes,
the most practical thing to do was to work in units, and that would depend on where you actually lived. So I belonged to the South London unit.
So what did you actually do then for the movement in exile? And did you have to combat the dirty tricks of the South African government? And I guess there was still a tension, even though you were in exile.
I don't think the whole truth is known, just how well organized the South Africans were abroad.
The government, yeah.
Especially in London. There were people all over. It was possible to go to South Africa House and say that I'm interested, I can pass on information. And I think the going rate at that time was £60 a month.
For
information. And that was good money in London in the 60s.
Backed up by the gold and diamonds of South Africa, of course.
Yes, and so it was a difficult period, and you had to be careful who you spoke to and what you did. The units, the essential thing about the units was to keep us informed and also raise funds. So I got involved in fundraising. Personally, there were lots of things you could do. People joined structures, joined political classes, etc. I chose two areas. One was to collect medical supplies from chemists for the forward areas in Angola, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. So I would do that. The other thing that I did on a regular basis was I would send out literature to South Africa illegally. Things like Sachaba, African Communist, pamphlets, whatever there was. And I enjoyed doing this because I felt it was something useful. I would get different colored envelopes. I would have different denomination stamps, different handwriting, different pens, and then mail them from different parts of London at different times. And how successful we were, I don't know, but I met a few people who said, oh, you were one of the people who sent these things to us.
So to whom were these addressed then?
We were given a mailing list from the ANC office, and we worked from that list.
And these were all over South Africa?
All over South Africa.
These would be safe addresses.
Because I remember writing to quite a number of clerics.
Okay.
And who did you come in contact? Who did you work with? I mean, this, of course, was a time when we had giants of the liberation struggle like Oliver Tambo and Yusuf Dadu and J.B. Marks and others. And I know that Dadu was in London.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Tambo was in, I guess, Lusaka or Dar. Who are the sorts of people that you interacted with in the branch and in your work? And how did you get on with your fellow South Africans in exile?
The units, there was an RPC, a regional political committee, and they met and they would decide the agenda and feed that into the units. And we would have two or three big meetings every year where the entire membership would get together. And there you'd meet all the comrades. But on a monthly basis, we met people from South London Unit.
Mm.
The people I worked with, who were also in the South London Unit, Frenny Jenwa,
oh, yes, yes,
who later became Speaker of the House.
Yes, yes.
Quite a formidable lady.
Mm-hmm.
Jill Marcus,
mm-hmm,
who also became a Member of Parliament. And Herbie Pele, the Piscan. My brother was in the same unit. Paul Joseph's brother was in that unit as well. So that's how we functioned. The other people that we met, but not on a regular basis, people like Isu Pahad, Aziz Pahad, Ronnie Press, and a few of the other people's names, Percy Cohen, Paul Joseph, these were people who worked in other units. And the fundraising, we all came together, we did that as a joint affair. So we had an annual bazaar and would raise thousands of pounds for the movement.
And of course this was, by the 70s and 80s, this was a time of escalating campaigns for sanctions.
Right.
For the freeing of Mandela. So there are all these wonderful campaigns around the world, in the US and in Britain, elsewhere. Maybe we should... Would you like to add anything about those decades? Maybe the anti-apartheid movement in general and
we worked
campaigns?
We worked with the anti-apartheid movement, but we always kept our membership distinct.
Hmm.
So... We weren't, there was no reason why we couldn't, but if we were in the ANC, we didn't become members of the anti-apartheid movement. But we did work very closely with them, especially when we had very big marches and demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
We always worked as one, because mm-hmm, they were very good and they were very strong. Of course, the one... I suppose black mark on the anti-apartheid movement was the City of London anti-apartheid movement. This was the group that went to camp outside South Africa House and had a 24-hour vigil, and they kept that up for years. That was remarkable in its own right. But they were maverick in that they did not comply with what the ANC was trying to do. They wanted Mandela freed. And the ANC said, no, you don't free one person, everyone has to be freed.
Right.
And that was the basic difference between us and this particular group of breakaways in the anti-apartheid movement.
And that tension that was quite sharp tension at times, I guess, for political reasons.
It did create problems.
Mm. Well then, perhaps we could move on to your coming to this country and the Michigan State University experience, and John might like to take the lead here because he was on the ground before I came, and there's a whole range of things we could explore here, like South African students at MSU, Ahmed Kathrada's visits, uh-huh, and the book, visits of South Africans and projects, and your travels back to South Africa and even to other countries in Asia, and feelings on returning home. And of course, just last year we had a marvellous conference on the international anti-apartheid movement in Durban,
mm-hmm,
where you gave a wonderful presentation on your own experiences. But maybe I could, John, you could lead in here.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how you came to come to MSU?
Oh, okay.
Was it because of the marvellous Africa program at MSU?
Do you want a political answer, or you?
No. Little levity here.
I worked for an international organization in London, in the private sector. I'd left high school teaching and joined the Eurocentres, which was a European-based organization with its headquarters in Switzerland. And somehow, the director of the Eurocentres and John Hanna were very friendly. Mm-hmm. And somewhere, sometimes
John Hanna being the president,
at that time. Yeah. And sometime in the 70s, MSU actually hosted a program for Eurocentre students from mostly Western European countries. Mm-hmm. And that, for some reason, died a natural death. I think there was not all that much enthusiasm, or people weren't interested or didn't really know the Eurocentre program. So in 1987, I was approached and asked if I'd like to go to a university in the States to see if it's possible to set up an association with Eurocentres. So this I did in 1988. Mm-hmm. And when I was told I'm going to East Lansing, I dashed home and told Ursula, I've accepted a job, it's in East Lansing, where on earth is it? I knew Michigan, but so we found East Lansing and said, okay, and that's what brought me to MSU.
And initially you were here for...
Initially, well, the director of the Eurocentres said I could have carte blanche, I could stay as long as I wanted, provided we were making headway. Mm-hmm. And if I felt that things weren't going to work out, then I would go back to London. So, because it was such a different operation from the European model, it took me a whole semester to really understand what was happening in the English Language Center where I was based. And I would write reports and send off memos to Zurich. And I decided that I'd stay for the summer and see if I could do some more work and actually put some of the material that would be acceptable to Eurocentres and to the English Language Centre. And I ended up staying for the whole year.
This was 88.
Hmm?
Was this 88?
88. Very early on, I met you in 1988. Mm-hmm. I met David Wiley, and I got very interested in the work of the African Study Centre. And one thing I remember that sticks out is there was a movie house in East Lansing called the Odeon.
Odeon, in Frandor, yes.
In Frandor. Mm-hmm. And they were showing A World Apart.
That's right, I remember that, yes.
And I went and I said to the manager, I said, would it be possible to put a box out there to collect money for South Africa? This was 1988. And I was quite taken aback when he said, certainly, take a box and put it there, and but you have to be responsible. So, not knowing just what I could expect, I put a little plastic box out there and just a little note, this is collecting money for, you know, people who are suffering in South Africa. And I went to check, and on the first evening, it was overflowing with dollar bills.
Oh my goodness.
And I was completely astounded at the goodwill and the interest of the local people in East Lansing. And that was another thing that truly impressed me. So that in October, when the dean asked me if I'd be interested in a job, I didn't have any hesitation in saying, yes, I met people in the African Study Centre. I felt there was a lot I could do in the English Language Centre, and I felt that this had possibilities.
This was the Dean of Arts and Letters, not of International Studies.
This was Arts and Letters.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I went back at the end of the year, and as far as I knew, that was the end of my contact and association with MSU. And then I got October 89, or just before then, I got an offer to start work at the English Language Centre, and I took it up.
So you then moved to the US from 1990, was it, or 89?
And 1990. April 1990, I came to MSU, and one of the first things I did was, having received an invitation to become a core faculty member of the African Study Centre, I joined.
Wonderful.
And I have always enjoyed that part of my work very much.
And of course, this was a very momentous time in South Africa. The freeing of Mandela in February of 1990, and maybe you could explain the how you came to then bring Kathy Ahmed Kathrada here to East Lansing, and the editing of this marvelous book of his correspondence.
Well, one thing I need to add is that I had accepted the offer of a job. There was no contract. I discovered MSU has no contract, but I had given my word. I said I would start in April. And just before that, in October 89, Kathrada, Sisulu, and four others were released from prison. And I contacted him and spoke to him, and wonderful. Then in February of 1990, Mandela was released. And I was in torment. I finally had a chance to go back home, and I wanted to break the contract. I really did, but I also felt honor bound, and I said, well, I'll go back later. This never happened. But coming back to Kathrada, a chance meeting in the African Study Center, we were talking, and someone had mentioned that it was a visitor from out of town, I can't remember who now, had mentioned that he had gone to South Africa, had met this remarkable ex-Rivonia prisoner, Ahmed Kathrada, and had sight of some of his prison correspondence. And I just mentioned casually that, I know about that, I used to write to Kathrada. And then someone asked if I had any of the letters, and pure sentiment, I had brought most of the letters that Kathy had written to me while I was in London. I brought them to the States, and I said, yes, I've got a few, and arranged to see the Dean of the College of Arts and Letters to see whether they'd be interested. He read a few of the letters and said, definitely interested. Can you get all the letters? So I said, well, I could ask Kathrada, and it was a strange conversation I had with Kathrada on the phone. I phoned him and I said, Michigan State University is very interested in your prison correspondence. Would you be willing to let them have the collection? And he said, Bob, why on earth would people want to read those letters? You know how boring they are. And I happened to agree with him. And I said, yes, I know they're boring, but for some reason, MSU would like to have them.
Historians are funny people.
And, I mean, he was surprised, and he said, look, if that's... He said, are you sure? And I said, they would really like to have the letters. He said, well, come and get them. Mm-hmm. And that's how contact was made with Kathy, and he eventually came in 93 or 94, mm-hmm. and came at least once a year after that for a number of years.
There was some interesting scrapes, I understand, in the city of Lansing, and with little political jousts, and I heard some stories about Kathrada's visits.
David Wiley decided to take Kathrada to downtown Lansing, the United Nations Day or something.
That's right. Yes.
And I don't know, were you there?
Yes, he received the key to the city, correct?
That's right, he was given the keys to the city.
City, right.
But a lot of the Michigan militia
right.
were in attendance in significant numbers and were boycotting this and saying they were anti-United Nations. And David Wiley, feeling very protective, said to apologized to Cathy and said, "You know, I'm really sorry. Is it okay?" And Cathrada said, "Never felt more at home."
That's right. There's racism and repression everywhere.
Yeah.
What about the South Africans then in East Lansing, the students, the faculty over the years? I mean, you've been here now nearly 15 years, I guess, and you must have seen some students come and go, and you must have paid some visits back to South Africa. Mm-hmm. When was your first visit home then?
End of 91.
91.
Mm-hmm.
And did you see Cathrada then?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I always see him when I go to South Africa and sometimes stay at his place, but we always get together.
What about the students or the faculty coming through here from South Africa?
One of the things that I tried to do, and I hope I was able to be of some assistance, is that being in the English Language Centre, we were also, in a way, although it wasn't official, we were gatekeepers regarding language proficiency, and all international students, regardless of where they're from, even from Britain technically or Canada, had to go through the English Language Centre to either get language clearance or to get officially told that they had met the requirements. And I worked with the Department of Education quite often and other departments unofficially in assisting the South Africans overcome this hurdle of language proficiency. And so that used to be my first contact with the newly arrived South Africans. And then, of course, through the African Study Centre, on a more formal basis, we were able to meet the South Africans and have contact with them. And when Cathrada came, we always made sure that he met all the South Africans. And on one visit, he came with Barbara Hogan, and she addressed the South African women on campus.
And we've had some South African ambassadors come through in recent years. You missed Barbara Masekela this year.
Barbara Masekela, but certainly saw Sheila Sisulu, whom I got to know fairly well.
Mm.
Was she in London at the same time that you were in London then? Or?
No, Sheila wasn't in London. Sheila was somewhere in Africa. I met Sheila for the very first time in South Africa, very briefly, but when she was ambassador in Washington.
Okay. And what did it feel like in October last year when you went back to this international anti-apartheid conference in Durban, South Africa, that seeing old friends and also being in the company of a suite of MSU delegates? This must have been an interesting experience for you in some ways.
I think I'd sum it up in one word, schizophrenic. I was there as a member of the MSU group. I also felt I was back home. I was a South African. And my tag said UK. So you can understand the confusion. So there I was, travelling on a British passport, feeling very South African and representing MSU. But it was good. And I enjoyed the conference. Unfortunately, didn't get to meet a whole lot of people. But for me, one of the highlights was interviewing some very, very interesting people. A member from the Swedish anti-apartheid movement, Randolph Vine, and Kada Asmal. So those were the three interviews that I did, and I found them absolutely fascinating. And on a personal level, I was absolutely delighted to be able to spend time with Billy Nyer, who is now retired from Parliament, and he's just an ordinary citizen. He lives in Durban, so we spent a lot of time together. I had lunch with him, and it was nice talking about the old times. And he remembered Fordsburg, 1956,
oh.
the
Because Billy Dyer was one of the titans, one of the leaders of the trade union movement in Natal in the 50s. Yeah. And, of course, he was active in the struggle against apartheid and, of course, finished up there in the treason trial. Well, it's been a wonderful tour through struggles in South Africa, through to MSU and the exile experience and your diverse experiences as an educator and as a member of the anti-apartheid movement. So on behalf of MSU and the library, I'd like to thank you, Bob, for joining us here today.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much.